Hi, and welcome to Prosody, 90.5's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and today we have a special program featuring the winners of the 2012 Writers' Cafe Contest, sponsored by the Writing Center of the University of Pittsburgh. With us today are three writers reading their winning pieces of poetry, fiction, and creative nonfiction. And we'll also talk with writer Barbara Edelman, who will talk about the Writers' Cafe and the Writing Center. We'll start with the poetry winner, Joshua M. Patton. He has won first and second place in poetry this year. Hi, Josh. How are you?
Doing wonderful, Jan. Glad to be back.
Yeah, you were actually here last year because you won last year, so you kind of must be a good writer then.
That's what they tell me.
Okay. So I know that you are a veteran of the U.S. Army and you spent time in Iraq. Does any of that find its way into your writing?
A lot of it does. I haven't written about the war or anything in sort of like a fiction or creative nonfiction kind of way, but it did creep into my poetry, much to my surprise.
Okay. Well, let me read your bio here. Joshua M. Patton is a Pittsburgh native and veteran of the U.S. Army, currently attending the University of Pittsburgh, thanks to the post-9/11 GI Bill. He is a regular contributor to Veterans Journal and magazine. One of his essays has appeared in Hot Metal Bridge. So, if you could you read a couple poems for us?
Absolutely. Okay. Faking It. My car was totaled when a drunk driver ended his zigzag crashing spree into the 1997 Pontiac Sunfire, given to me by my great aunt when she realized she shouldn't drive anymore. It was never a car I loved. My friends called it a girl car, which I suppose it was, since it belonged to my aunt. It wasn't my car, but I used it. Football is faking. You can pump fake or fake someone out while running. You can fake punt or fake go for it. You can fake a pass, then run, or fake a run, then pass. You can fake answer questions to reporters. You can be fake to other players, other coaches, other coworkers, or friends. You fake it all, but you can't fake what you are, even if that is something reprehensible. Critic Andrew Lang called the spirit of forgery the 10th muse, but even that is a fake. The 10th Muse is a site for fan fiction, or fake stories about established characters, entwined in romances that never happen on their show, or in their stories, or what have you. Or, The 10th Muse is a book by Joyce Jones, a cookbook editor that published it as a part memoir, part cookbook. Or, The 10th Muse is a gallery in Maplewood, New Jersey, where one can buy original art. Sappho was called The 10th Muse, but was also referred to as The Poetess. The first American poetess, or published poet, was Anne Bradstreet, who began her collection's 83-word title with The 10th Muse. The10thmuse.com is a website run by poet Joanna Lee, complete with fake snowfall. With my car totaled, I was stuck at a friend's house. He was married with two kids, and this was the first time entertaining the fellas from work. Rather than feel bad for myself, I felt bad for him. He can't throw one party without some drunk in his neighborhood wrecking his guest's car. My friend Rob was headed towards my side of town. He said he'd give me a ride. In the car, I was unusually silent. "I know what you need," Rob said. I knew he was heading to the strip club, so I told him that spending money to see naked women was the last thing I needed to do. "I'll pay for the dance," he replied. Since he was driving, it seemed rude to argue with the man. In the club, I eyed the weathered women of the stage as they danced listlessly to 70s rock. Sitting and sipping whiskey, Rob and I decide which girl will lighten my misery. Rob points out a woman, full-figured and bare on the stage. Her body moves sensuously, but her stare in the mirror is all business. She's watching herself, perfecting her craft. I like the initiative. I agree with his assessment and wait for her to finish her set on the stage. Right as she exits, an olive-skinned beauty with dark hair emerges from another door. She had been upstairs where the lap dances happen. She smiled and laughed and looked like heaven. I went with packaging over professionalism. Nat Tate was a fake artist. Writer William Boyd, in collaboration with Gore Vidal, David Bowie, and others, published a biography about Nat Tate, saying he was an undervalued artist. The payoff was a party hosted by Bowie, in which excerpts of the book were read aloud and the paintings of Tate were on display. While not everyone was fooled, many critics not only admitted to liking his work, but claimed to have heard of him before the book, so as not to appear foolish. "Do you know the rules?" she asked. I didn't, but wanted clarification. I assumed it was no touching, no asking for real names, no eye contact with the dancer. "You can touch anywhere but the cracks in the hole," she said. The dance began, and I tentatively touched the woman. She leaned back. I caressed a breast. They were fake, hard, ungiving, cold. My finger found a lump. My touch became more clinical. I looked at her worried. "Do you want me to stop?" she asked. I thanked her and tipped her $10. The second poem is, it's called Drug Education. At a dank hotel in Columbus, Ohio, surrounded by three women, all talking loud and fast, I bent over a line of white powder and snorted. It hurt and tasted terrible. I thought maybe the stern man who once cooked an egg and told me it was my brain wasn't completely wrong. Still, the women were in various stages of undress, and I had a real shot at one of them. I hoped the stern man would understand.
That's the poetry of Joshua M. Patton, first and second place winner of the University of Pittsburgh Writers Cafe contest. Thanks, Josh.
Thank you, Jen.
I'm talking with the poet Barbara Edelman, who is a lecturer in English at the University of Pittsburgh and co-coordinator of the Writers Cafe, along with Ellen McGrath Smith. Edelman's poems and prose have appeared in Prairie Schooner, Rattle, 5 AM, Arts and Letters, and the Cimarron Review, as well as in several anthologies. She received a Pennsylvania Council on the Arts grant in poetry and is the author of a poetry chapbook, A Girl in Water, from Parallel Press at the University of Wisconsin. She was awarded a 2012 Students' Choice Award for Teaching Excellence from the College of General Studies at the University of Pittsburgh. Hi, Barbara. How are you doing?
Hi, Jan. Doing well. Nice to see you.
Yeah. Thanks so much for coming. I know that you're the co-coordinator of the Writers' Cafe and the Writing Center also. Is that right? Or the Writers'
Cafe? No, I'm not coordinating the Writing Center. Thank goodness. they'd be in trouble.
Okay.
But I work at the Writing Center. I'm a consultant there.
Oh, okay. Can you tell us a little bit about the Writers' Cafe, like what it is? And I know that you host visiting writers, et cetera. Can you tell us about it?
Sure. Well, first I want to thank you, Jan and Prosody, for being with the contest throughout. And I also understand that you helped get the Writers' Cafe started in 2003. So it was an initiative by Geeta Kothari, who is the director of the Writing Center, and it was truly built up by the founding coordinator, Ellen Smith. And it's a place for writers either in the writing major or in other disciplines to explore their writing in a more informal setting. So we find facilitators, writers from the community, some from Pitt, some from the surrounding area, who come in and offer usually exercises for students. It meets on Fridays from 3 to 5. We have approximately 7 sessions per semester. And it's a wonderfully informal way for writers to write and to share their work. Mm-hmm. We've had a wonderfully committed group this year.
Mm-hmm. And is it for only Pitt writers, or people can visit? Or
actually, it's open to members of the community.
Oh, great.
And we post the sessions on Facebook.
Okay.
And we do have a good attendance, but we focus on Pitt writers, that
right.
The primary core are Pitt writers.
Okay. And do you still have pizza? I remember you used to have pizza at these meetings.
Well, I'm afraid we haven't had pizza lately. We have cookies,
oh, okay.
Which I'm very fond of.
Yes.
Pretzels.
Some kind of food is essential.
I think we have pizza for our final reading of the semester.
Oh, okay, good to know. Okay. Well, it's a great program. I mean, I know that recently you had the writers Judith Vollmer and Toy Derricotte come in, so you have some pretty high-powered writers coming in.
That was a terrific session.
Yeah.
And so the contest itself has been going on for 9 years, and the judges are writers from the community. This year, the fiction judge was Robert Yoon. The poetry judge was Beth Newborg, who's a lecturer at Pitt. And the creative nonfiction judge was Robin Jodlowski, who's an MFA in creative nonfiction and editor-in-chief of Pitt's online literary magazine, Hot Metal Bridge. And all the judging is done anonymously.
Okay, well, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guests today are the winners of the 2012 Writers' Cafe Contest from the University of Pittsburgh. The first place fiction winner in the Writers' Cafe Contest is Nina Schabach. Nina Schabach is a junior fiction major and French minor from Fairmont, West Virginia. She's a writer of fiction, poetry, and creative nonfiction. Her work has appeared in the University of Pittsburgh's Collision magazine, Fairmont State University's Whetstone, and in the Pittsburgh City Paper. Her forthcoming poetry chapbook is entitled Naming the Mountain, published by the Poetry Society of New Hampshire. Hi, Nina. How are you?
Great.
And is this your third year that you've been a winner in the Writers' Cafe contest?
It is.
You have to be graduating soon, right?
Next year.
Okay. Wow, that's great. Congratulations again.
Thank you.
And you're a winner in the fiction and creative nonfiction part.
That's right.
Wow, very impressive. Okay. So, but right now you're reading fiction. Is that correct?
That's right.
Okay. So go ahead. Tell us the title and go ahead.
The title is Something Small and Made of Fire. That was the summer Moira Bishop fell in love. It was drought season, and her best friend was trying to get engaged to a boy who played the musical saw. The girls spent almost every night outside Gad's only bar, waiting for his thin voice to tune to high C. They were still too young to enter the premises or look straight at bourbon without squinting. There wasn't much else to do. Julie and Moira sat in the parking lot and named the shapes of falling stars, and Moira couldn't tell a single constellation from Orion's belt. They were friends because they had always been friends, and they anticipated always being friends, at least until the musical saw boy arrived. He had 9 1/2 fingers and an eye that drifted slowly as he spoke, as though he were reading the Sunday comics. Julie had first seen him at Goodwill, where she worked Saturdays, checking each donated book for love letters and used prophylactics. He had pierced ears, Julie said later that night, when they were teaching themselves to smoke in the treehouse bridging their yards. And a tattoo on his cheek, or maybe it was a mole, but it might have been a tattoo. Who tattoos their cheek, Moira said. People who don't care about people like you, Julie said. Give me a light. The boy had made one sweep of the floor and then circled back around to Julie's section. He smelled like metal. Warm, too, like a hot car. He stood behind her and watched her pull poems out of the DSM-1 for a few minutes. You have pretty hands, he said. Julie said later that she hadn't known how to answer. She stretched her fingers out on the page so he could admire them, framed hallucination and psychosis with her thumb. She said he laughed then, his breath heating the back of her neck, and put his own hand down on top, and held her fingers so tight against the letters she could read them without looking. Julie had stood there for as long as she could without turning around, and when she did, she pressed up on a soft mouth waiting. That was the way with boys. In the treehouse, Moira breathed clouds of smoke. What do you mean, people like me, she said. His mouth tasted like mint, Julie said, the kind my mom grows. What do you mean, Moira said again, and Julie said, does it matter? Move over. She stretched out her soft legs and put her head on Moira's stomach, her hair slick against the top of Moira's shorts, and pursed her lips around her cigarette like she was kissing 1,000 Goodwill boys. You're warm, she said, and Moira began to apologize, but she said, no, no, I like it. Moira traced Julie's left ear and listened for footsteps in the grass. It was past dinner time, already sermon writing time, almost Julie can't, you come inside time, but they were untouchable here. Just them and Julie's story and the meteor sky. And who would come looking and what would give them away? They had learned the trick to blowing smoke rings by the time Julie arrived in the treehouse with the new story. The boy had come back after a week, wearing a plaid button-down so tight against his hips it felt indecent to look. This time he didn't stop to talk at the table where Julie sorted books, but tossed a paperback into her hands before disappearing into the racks of polyester dresses.
That was Nina Schaubuck, first place winner in the Writers Cafe contest. Great details and voice in there.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Up next, we'll hear the work of Taylor Breslin, second place fiction winner. She is a graduating senior in the fiction program at the University of Pittsburgh. And reading for Taylor is Barbara Edelman.
The story is As If You're Fooling Anyone. Mira is a high school history teacher. The history department is a big boys' club, and she's been passed over to teach an upper-level course on 20th century history. She's also forgotten her one-year anniversary with her boyfriend. So first, the scene in the school. Mira objected. She had seniority, she told them. She had been waiting to teach an upper-level class since she started at Western. Her students had good test scores, seemed to like her well enough. The baseball coach said, "It's not about your ability, honey. Rawls did a concentration in World War I." Honey, Rawls. She had to suppress the urge to throw her pen at his flushed, square face. "My concentration was the Civil Rights Movement. They're both in the 20th century." She could see it in their faces. They might as well have scoffed her. They might as well have ruffled her hair with the false, condescending affection of a distant uncle. For them, history meant wars. That was why they left her out. They thought she couldn't teach wars. The position went to Raleigh, who never said a word beyond thank you. As a consolation prize, Mira was given an extra section of ninth grade civics, which was deemed a more appropriate venue for teaching the civil rights movement. They arrived at the restaurant 7:03, after a largely silent car ride. They had never been to the place before, and as soon as Mira saw the entrance, the clean, bare lines of the sign above the slick metal doors, she knew they were out of their league. Perhaps he wanted to impress her. Perhaps he wanted to assert that they were adults. They were. They could function in the kind of relationship that lasts more than a year. The kind that goes to formal restaurants on Tuesday nights. When they entered and approached the maitre d', Mira realized that they were in over their heads even more than she had originally thought. He had not been aware they even had restaurants like it in their area. One far from major cities, floating in a sea of loosely connected suburbs. The dining room was bright and open, but also somehow intimate, with a crisp white tablecloth and black napkins, black drapes, metallic sculptures hanging on the spotless walls. Her boyfriend walked up to the maitre d', claimed their reservation. "The dining room requires jackets of men," he replied, bored. She looked at her boyfriend. He was wearing an Oxford shirt, surprisingly crisp for him, though no one but her would know that. It had a small pattern of blue lines like graph paper. "Oh," he said in the general direction of the maitre d', already defeated, already out of cards to play. "Do you have a jacket you can wear? Perhaps in your vehicle?" He overpronounced every syllable. "Yes, you probably grew up within 10 miles of here." "No," her boyfriend responded. She was torn between her impulse to help him and her impulse to leave, to tug off her heels and walk all the miles home, to deadbolt the door against him. The maitre d' dug under his stand and pulled out a battered black suit jacket. He held it out between his thumb and forefinger. "Forget it, we can go," Mira said. She could not, at that moment, think of a greater indignity. But he took the jacket and pulled it on. It strained over his shoulders and ran short in the wrists. He couldn't button it, stood hunched like an awkward, hulking child on school picture day. "This way," the maitre d' said, barely moving his thin, colorless lips. They both sat stiff, paralyzed by the pressure of the occasion, the quiet clinking of the other diners. She could feel his disappointment at her, even as he glanced up occasionally from his menu. She ordered something light, small, delicately arranged. "As if you're fooling anyone." There was a couple at the table next to them who had brought their two children, a boy of about 5 in a pinstriped jacket and tie, asleep with his head on the table, coin-cut carrots scattered on his plate, and an infant girl babbling quietly in a high chair. The girl was nearest to Mira, turned slightly toward her. The baby smiled at Mira and reached out with one pudgy, sticky hand to try to grab her hair or shirt sleeve. "I want a baby," Mira sighed, sinking back in her chair. Her boyfriend looked at her with some alarm. Oh, no, she said. She sat up straight.
That was the work of second place fiction winner Taylor Breslin.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guests today are the winners of the 2012 Writers' Cafe Contest from the University of Pittsburgh. The next reader is the first place winner in creative nonfiction, Nina Schabach, who was also the first place winner in fiction. Okay, Nina, if you could read your piece.
The title is Little Red Sister. Did I ever tell you that my grandfather got nosebleeds? Did I ever tell you that Leviticus 17:11 says, the life of a creature is in the blood, but I haven't decided if I believe it? Did I ever tell you that a single air bubble in one of your veins could kill you if it travels to the heart? That the body holds 5 liters of blood, but it isn't enough? Did I ever tell you that I used to watch crime shows back to back in the afternoons before my parents came home? I looked away during the reenactments as though someone were really about to die, and I was saving them the humiliation of being seen. The narrator said, blood spatter experts found evidence on the ceiling. I tried to imagine a heart that could pump that hard. Did I ever tell you that Oct 1 and 3-1 is the odorant responsible for the smell of blood, like pennies, old ballpoints, the sweet stink of skinned knees? Did I ever tell you that once, when I was 7 or 8, I walked into my grandparents' kitchen to find my grandfather hunched over the counter, holding a handkerchief to his nose? The cloth was slick and bright red. My aunt was at his elbow, talking to someone who maybe didn't exist. If it doesn't stop in 45 minutes, we'll have to go to the hospital again. He leaned against the formica and searched for a clean spot and stood, chin down, in praying posture, the same way he watched the Pope on TV. Did I ever tell you that when I turned 18, I went to a blood drive? I couldn't watch the nurse insert the needle because I was afraid, and my heart thudded like an engine that wouldn't quite turn over. I lay on a gurney and counted the volleyballs stuck in the gym rafters. I did not look at the collecting bag. After 10 minutes, a nurse came by and frowned and said, just sit tight, and I sat tight. And another nurse came over and said, and I sat tight. And a third nurse said, there isn't any more blood coming out. Your bag is half full. I may have apologized. How embarrassing to run out of blood. Did I ever tell you that this is my body and this is my blood? He passed the chalice, saying. Did I ever tell you that the summer before sophomore year, I got a nosebleed in the afternoon? I had been reading, and then I was on my feet and hunched over the kitchen sink. I pinched my nose to make it stop, but the blood was going down my throat, too, in clots and warm trickles. I uncovered one nostril and watched a drop splatter against the drain. My father hummed in another room. If it doesn't stop in 45 minutes, we'll have to go to the hospital again. I did not want to die. Did I ever tell you that movie blood is just syrup and food coloring? A bit of water to help it run. Did I ever tell you that after I didn't die, I turned on the faucet to wash the sink out and then stood there at a loss? For one moment, everything was suspended in midair, the neighbors watering their lawn and children falling palms first to the asphalt and the sparrows with their quick sparrow hearts. I waited for instruction. Then I ran myself a glass of water and spat out the taste.
Next, we'll hear from second-place winner in creative nonfiction, Brittany Warwick. Brittany Warwick is a junior at the University of Pittsburgh, majoring in both English writing, poetry, and English literature, with a minor in linguistics. She was born in Pittsburgh and grew up in Scottsdale, PA. She hopes to pursue a graduate degree in poetry. Hi, Brittany. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Okay. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Okay, so what are you reading today?
My essay is entitled Press Pause. I am 20 years old, therefore I cannot begin this essay with the phrase, back in my day, without losing some, if not all, credibility. I am not old enough to possess the right to proclaim that things were better or simpler or both when I was young, because I was young not long ago. I am still relatively young. But things have changed. In 20 years, numerous things have been altered, revamped, replaced, lost. The lost is what concerns me. sitting in the Mac Lab of the Robert Henderson Language Media Center, located on the ground floor of the Cathedral of Learning, the most overrated building on Pitt's campus, I feel misplaced. I've never used a Mac before. My phonetics professor tells us that the instructions and materials for today's lab are listed on CourseWeb. With the help of a fellow classmate, I upload the sound files into Prot, click View and Edit, and then they appear, spectrograms. I hear someone say, "This is stupid. It's just a bunch of gray, fuzzy junk." But there's something beautiful about them. We're measuring formants, my professor continues. Formants are bands of higher energy. They form when clusters of harmonics occur close to the resonance frequency. Why am I still staring at the screen? There's some sort of connection happening here, but what? These bars and lines look alive, buzzing with energy, yet they are at a standstill, moments of phonation captured and expressed in shades of gray. I'm not thinking about spectrograms anymore. Sarah Crew is standing amongst a group of girls, telling a story from the Ramayana, the volume of her voice increasing as the climax draws nearer. And then Ravana is on the screen, his royal blue skin against a sunny background. And then the moment is paused. Ravana's blue is blurring into the yellow, and thick, strong bands of gray vibrations divide his frightening figure into segments, into vowels. I am a child again, sitting in front of the television, in front of the VCR, one finger on the pause button, another on play, and I'm switching back and forth, neck craned upward, in awe of the analog life on the screen. The Wikipedia page for VHS begins. The video home system, better known by its abbreviation, VHS, is a consumer-level analog recording video cassette standard developed by Victor Company of Japan. Another website adds, originally, VHS was an acronym for Vertical Helical Scan, a reference to the recording system used, but was later changed to the more consumer-friendly Video Home System. A smart move, I think. Put home in the name of anything, and people will gravitate toward it. Well, that isn't really the case anymore. Other words have become more favorable in the minds of consumers. Digital. Remastered. High definition. According to the etymology section of the DVD Wikipedia page, the official DVD charter documents specify that the basis of the DVD name stems from the term digital versatile disc. That's another one, versatile. Why buy something that lacks versatility? You can watch a DVD with a DVD player, a PlayStation, an Xbox, a computer. A VHS only plays in a VCR.
That's the work of Brittany Warwick, second place winner in creative nonfiction. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You've just heard the writing of the winners of the 2012 Writers Cafe contest, sponsored by the University of Pittsburgh Writing Center. Thanks so much to everyone for being here. You've been listening to Prosody, 90.5's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Saturday morning at 6:30 for Prosody, 90.5 FM.